Help KBOO Radio promote our upcoming membership drive, which begins on February 4th. Just go to the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and click on the blue banner to help us thunderclap our drive on social media. And be sure to tune in from February 4th to 14th for lots of special programs and gifts, including the first ever Bluegrass Marathon.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, The Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Welcome to Madness Radio. This is your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Joshua Wolf Schenck. He's the author of Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness. So welcome to Madness Radio, Joshua Wolf Schenck.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's really interesting to read your work about Lincoln's depression because your whole perspective on the meaning of his suffering comes from very different than the medical perspective that we often think of. So it's really inspiring to have you on Madness Radio, and I really encourage people to check out your book, Lincoln's Melancholy. And so it may be really surprising for people to hear that Lincoln was someone who struggled with what we would now call depression for his whole life. Is that right?
Yes, it is surprising. It surprised me. I started working on this story when I was in my mid-20s, and I was living in Washington, D.C., not far from the Lincoln Memorial, and that was my whole view of Lincoln, was what we see in the Lincoln Memorial, which is this view of a man as God. In fact, the Lincoln Memorial is designed, the model for it is a statue of Zeus on his throne, and it's very intentionally designed to create this feeling of awe and people who approach it. You climb up these huge marble steps and you're in this temple and his words are inscribed, etched in marble on the walls, and this towering figure in his great chair looking peaceful and wise. It was totally shocking to me when I began to encounter the story of Lincoln's depressions as a young man, which are classic depressions of despair and sorrow that's never ending, and a feeling of hopelessness, ruminations on suicide, and a real alarm in his friends and community, in a sense that he really was in danger of killing himself, to the extent that twice in his early life there were suicide watches. They took active steps to keep him from hurting himself. Alongside this, in his late 20s, Lincoln came out of the closet, so to speak, as someone who was unusually morbid in his mind and ruminated and was preoccupied. He loved to read maudlin poetry, which, you know, gave expression to the cast of his mind. And while, you know, sorrow and many of these qualities are familiar to any human being, Lincoln really thought that he was unusual. He thought that he had a melancholy that was out of the norm, and that was the perspective of his friends too. They thought that he was a very unusually depressed man.
So when we hear that Lincoln was depressed, we're not just talking about he had some periods of feeling bad or feeling low, that he actually did have a very severe experience of what we would consider clinical depression, or whatever phraseology you want to use it. He was really suffering to the extreme that we think of depression can be for someone.
Yes, he was. And this gets to the core of the book and what's so interesting, because there are these two perspectives that we have to hold in mind simultaneously. And F. Scott Fitzgerald said, you know, this is the test of a first-rate mind. Can you hold two opposing ideas in mind? The first is that the clinical perspective is valuable, and that, you know, we can bring that to bear in this case and learn something about Lincoln and learn something about our own life And from this perspective, if you present the facts of Lincoln's case to any modern clinician, it is absolutely unambiguous. I mean, if you just go down the criteria and in the diagnostic and statistical manual, and you compare that against the very clear events of Lincoln's depressions as a young man, it's clear that he had major depressive episodes, and that he had at least two of them, probably more, but at least two of them, which is enough to say this man had what we would today call major depressive disorder. The second perspective we have to hold in mind, though, is that this is of limited utility. The value of diagnosing someone is in leading to some kind of treatment. And Lincoln is not before us to be treated. Diagnosis is also a snapshot of any moment in time. And with Lincoln, we have a whole story to tell. We have a whole life that he lived in front of us. And while I'm drawing in the book on modern psychiatry and psychology and literature and a whole variety of perspectives, sociology as well, I'm also trying to get into Lincoln's head into the perspective of the world around him so that we can learn today from the wisdom that was embodied in his life. So this leads us to a perspective that really challenges the clinical perspective, which says, you know, the clinical perspective says, look, let's identify disease so that we can treat it. And Lincoln's life suggests that we also need to identify qualities of character and qualities of a life that, while maybe troubling, maybe even dangerous, also have elements of value. And over the course of Lincoln's life, the challenges of his despair were wrapped up in what made him a man preoccupied with meaning, hardworking, searching in his mind for something bigger than the ordinary world around him. And this was a huge part of what led him to what we so appreciate about him.
So we've been talking about Lincoln's depression or his melancholy kind of as a feature of his personality or his character. I'm also very interested when I hear people talk about depression, if there might be something that he was depressed about, some loss or trauma or experience or hardship that he had maybe in his family or his childhood. Was there something that may have been driving him to be depressed?
It's a really good question, and I have to say we don't know. There was a significant loss in Lincoln's childhood. His mother died when he was a boy. His sister died in childbirth when he was older. I think he was a teenager at the time. His first breakdown, the first time he was suicidal, and really the time his depression became manifest, seems to have been provoked by the death of a young woman that he knew well, was friendly with. There may have been some romance there, although it's entirely uncertain, but it's very clear that after her death, Lincoln went off the rails. And perhaps that, you know, woke in him a real tenderness around the death of loved ones. That said, it was really quite common to lose a mother in that time. I think that I remember right that half of the U.S. presidents in the 19th century lost a parent when they were young. So many of the things that Lincoln went through were common, and yet clearly his depression is not a common depression. Lincoln actually addressed this directly with his usual acuity. He said that there may be particular causes of a depression, but they really only get you if you have a nervous temperament to begin with. And so he understood that, yes, there were sort of external phenomena that were relevant and that needed to be addressed. Although he didn't talk about death in the family, he was talking about things like bad weather and so forth. But you have to understand that it's the interaction between these phenomena and a tender mind, someone who is vulnerable to these moods in the first place, that leads someone to where he was, which was morbidly depressed.
When Lincoln was going through this suffering, did he seek treatment? Was he trying to get his suffering alleviated? Were there kinds of doctors and different things that he did in his life to overcome his depression?
The answer is yes, but let me give some context. In order to understand Lincoln's melancholy, you have to look at his life according to these distinct phases that he went through. In his mid-20s, he had these major episodes. He was suicidal. He was very open about it. And he did seek treatment. And one time in particular, he was under the care of a physician, and that physician was doing for him the ordinary things that were done at the time, which seem, you know, bordering on barbaric now, bleeding and leeching and mercury, which was these mercury pills were very common treatments for what was then understood to be a disease relating to the black bile, according to this old Greek idea of the black bile. And they thought if they could just expunge that bile from the body, that it would lead to improvements. And mercury was a common treatment for that because, you know, when you ingest a poison, it does induce sweating and defecation and all kinds of things that they thought were the body kind of ridding itself of the black bile. That phase of Lincoln's life ran from his mid-20s to his early 30s. And after that, he got married, he began to have children, and his melancholy did not go away, but he no longer was kind of public about it in the same way. He was not frequently confessing his despair. He was not having these suicidal episodes. It became a much quieter, even in some ways philosophical melancholy. He would sit on the side of the room for long stretches of time. People were very aware that he was a melancholy man, but he was not seeking treatment. He was, to the extent that he was trying to get help, it was through strategies that he began to employ, like reading literature and trying to improve himself in his mind, trying to sharpen his mind through logical exercises, and especially telling jokes and stories, which was his primary therapy and a kind of self-developed therapy, although it was also very social. That was Lincoln would, for hours at a time, would tell these tall tales, and you know, he always wanted to know who had good jokes. He would soak them up, and then he would recycle them. This is a Southern tradition. If you go, you know, down in the Southern United States today, you can hear people swapping stories, and Lincoln was a real master of this.
I'm curious about why that transition took place. Why did he go from someone seeking treatment to developing his own strategies and approaches and ways of dealing with it himself?
I think about this a lot. I'm now 43 years old. I wrote this book from my late 20s to my mid-30s. I think that there's an element of this that is in the life cycle. Young people are more voluble and more comfortable in some ways letting it all hang out. And as time passes, there's a more resigned quality. With experience, one comes to accept that one is not entirely alone, and that these things need on some level to be endured. And in some ways, I think the early depressions of Lincoln's life were this kind of all or nothing thing, that he thought he needed to be rid of the suffering entirely, or that he would have to kill himself. And there was a shift into a quieter, more subtle, even more melancholy perspective in some ways, that this was his lot in life, and it was a matter of, you know, doing the work every day to try to be as good as he could, which is not the same necessarily as feeling as good as he could. And this was a conclusion that Lincoln came to in the depth of his despair, that he wanted to live, and he wanted to live to do something meaningful for the world that he would be remembered for. And that itself, I think, it's inspirational, but it's also, there's element of melancholy in it, that he did not intend to be a happy man. He intended to do something for other people that would be linked to his name through the ages.
So that perspective and that sort of life purpose arose from his experiences of depression and melancholy and the struggle that he went through?
They're certainly related. And just in terms of story, the moment when Lincoln really laid out his mission in life is at the moment of the depth of his despair. And he did it in a very explicit way. He told his best friend at the time, Joshua Speed, that he wanted to kill himself, that he could kill himself, but that he wasn't going to kill himself because he believed there was something meaningful for him to do in the world. If you just look at his own words, yes, there's a very direct link. Now, Lincoln was someone who was, you know, service-minded from a much earlier age and had this ambition even before his depression came upon him. So I don't want to tell a simplified story, but certainly the Depression is a major part of this picture of progress.
So one of the most fascinating things about your book is how you describe Lincoln's powerful character, the qualities of his personhood that made him an incredible leader. You talk about how that was actually bound up in his struggle with depression itself, that it wasn't just some kind of mental flaw that he was pushing aside, but that the process of him dealing with his melancholy built and created and honed his skills and abilities as a statesman.
Again, we need to hold the two perspectives in mind. I mean, is it better to be depressed or not depressed? It's better to not be depressed. I mean, I'm literally now imagining, just as a metaphor, you know, having a weight on my shoulders. I'd prefer not to have it on it, but if that leads me to, you know, press down, you know, in my legs, in order to carry that weight, it's going to strengthen me over time. There is a value, and, you know, we see this all through time and arts and letters and science and matters of state. People who, you know, feel the woes of their own lives most acutely, you know, may develop a kind of depth that serves them well and that serves other people well. In psychology alone, you think about great lights, and William James is my favorite psychologist and philosopher. And this was a man who suffered enormously and was trying to understand it and was trying to help himself and was trying to help other people.
And so what were some of the qualities that Lincoln developed through the struggle with his melancholy?
The things that made him feel better were reading and writing, which helped him connect to a world outside of his own mind and know that he was not alone, and it helped give voice. It helped articulate what was in his heart and his mind. And also these jokes and stories and this kind of this ritual of standing around a group of men, the lawyers that he was on the circuit with, or the guys in town, and swapping these stories. You know, it's a kind of like a culture, if you can imagine, like a stand-up comedy show, except, you know, no one's on stage. It's just a group of people kind of in a circle, and they're taking turns, and they're trying to top each other. And this was also a huge part of Lincoln's life, and it made him a better communicator. It made him a lot of the way Lincoln communicated, a lot of what makes his rhetoric so powerful is that he, you know, he could be a very high-minded philosopher, but he could also speak in the vernacular. He could, you know, he could tell very earthy stories, even bawdy stories, not in public, but in private. I mean, he would say a lot of things that you know, mothers would want to cover their children's ears if they heard it.
How did his melancholy drive him to be this storyteller and kind of like a stand-up persona?
Well, it was just a very direct thing. This is what made him feel better. He said that these stories, the vents to my moods and gloom, that they gave him relief. It was pleasurable. It's such a common story that it's a cliche, but like many cliches, it reflects a deep truth. You're either going to laugh or cry, and laughter is a lot more fun and also something that you can join in with other people around.
So it was a way for him to no longer be isolated with his suffering, in a sense.
That's right.
And did he develop courage? Because I know that facing suicidal feelings in yourself is a terrifying, terrifying thing. And then repeatedly in his life as a politician, he had to develop the courage within himself to face extraordinary challenges. Was there a connection there as well?
I think so. You know, he was not rattled by the dark and the difficult and the challenging. He expected it. He was not optimistic in a way that led people to delusion. He tended to look for the worst in any situation in order to grapple with it. And that was certainly a lifelong habit of mine that sprang at least in part from his qualities of melancholy.
You mentioned a study that was done that actually demonstrates that people who are depressed have a more realistic perspective on what's happening. Can you tell us about that?
It's a classic psychological study, and it came up with this idea called depressive realism, that, you know, people who are depressed are more likely to understand the truth of a situation, even if it's kind of a grim truth. People who are not depressed tend to often distort reality in a way that that makes them feel better. And there's the height of this perspective is a brilliant little paper that is a satire, but it bears a lot of truth, in which a psychologist says he's going to diagnose happiness as a mental disorder. And he goes through and he lays out a lot of these cognitive distortions that happy people face. And I mean, if you go through the day not recognizing that you're going to die, not recognizing, you know, as you hurtle down the street, you know, at 85 miles an hour in a multi-ton vehicle, that you are inches away from calamity. I mean, if you do these things that we all absolutely need to do and not to be crippled by fear, you are actually dispelling a truthful quality of the world. And obviously, people who are depressed can become crippled by these fears and these realities, even if they're true. But there is a value in it. There's value in grappling with the darkest elements of our realities.
So if someone who's happy might say, well, you know, things are going to get better, but Lincoln might more realistically, from his melancholic perspective, say, well, things are bad, but they might actually get a lot worse, which is kind of what happened with the Civil War. I mean, it was a spiral down into an absolute horror
that's right.
Him to be the president of a nation that's going to war with so much violence, and to have that discipline and that courage to remain steady with his commitment must have taken an extraordinary ability to face the horrors of the situation that you're saying that maybe he learned from facing some of the horrors inside of himself.
Yes, that's very well said.
And were there other qualities that he developed out of his depression? You mentioned humility, I think.
Yeah, the humility is central. The sense that, you know, on some level, you know, we're not in control, and in order to get through this life, we need to capitulate to that and recognize that. And of course, humility is, you know, very different than, you know, a nihilistic resignation. Lincoln's humility, certainly at his best, was a humility that said, look, I am a very small piece in an order that's much bigger than anything I can comprehend, and yet I have my bit to do.
And what do you think are some of the implications of your understanding of Lincoln's greatness being connected to his melancholy, the implications for our understanding about politicians and leadership today? Because we have this view that if you have any kind of mental flaw at all, you're disqualified. It's seen as a flaw. It's not seen as something that might actually build your character or give you strength. I mean, for some politicians, if it comes out that you've had any kind of mental health struggles, then people aren't going to vote for you, or they're not going to believe that you have this capacity. What do you think are some of the implications of that?
The big turning point in modern times was Thomas Eagleton, who was chosen by McGovern in 1972 to be his running mate, to be the candidate for vice president. And it emerged that he had had nervous breakdowns, had been in hospitals, and had had shock therapy. And that became a great scandal, and he withdrew from the race, and it was radioactive from then on out for any political figure to have any kind of mental health profile. And to this day, I mean, I don't think you would ever see a major political figure confessing to have been in psychotherapy. I mean, I know that Barack Obama is a big fan of Lincoln, and I wouldn't be surprised if he had read my book, but I don't think he would ever even say that, because it would just immediately kick up this firestorm of, you know, is he depressed? And in so many areas of life, we're so far beyond it. In the arts, and so many public figures can speak openly of their struggles, and we can recognize that a great deal of strength may coexist with this fantastic fragility that is, you know, struggles with mental health. But in politics, it's just entirely verboten. Their insistence on a kind of plastic, fake, relentlessly upbeat, optimistic perspective, and it's a disaster. It's just, leadership comes from reckoning with reality in a full way, and the kind of character who can reckon with reality is going to be one, you know, who experiences some darkness. As constituents, we should demand this of our leaders. A friend of mine recently sent me something that he wrote, and he said, I want you to read it if you have time, and I want you to tell me what you like and what you hate. And he said, if you don't hate any of it, I'm going to know you haven't read it. You know, we should say to our politicians, tell us about how you see the world in it, and if there isn't darkness in it, we know you're lying. We're not going to believe you. We're not going to trust you, and we need to shift the way that politicians are reported on, where these scandals are made of any kind of lapse into humanity. We need to just take a step back and say, what will we expect? Let's say, you know, in our families, we look up to our older brothers or our fathers or our mothers, you know. We understand that respecting them and admiring them is not inconsistent with seeing that they're human, that they make mistakes, that they have eccentricities, and we need to bring that same human perspective to the political realm.
In having studied Lincoln's depression and melancholy, what do you think are some of the personal lessons that people might get about their own depression?
Well, the big story is to look at the arc of Lincoln's life and these three things that he did over the course of his life. Number one, acknowledge his depression. He was very open about it. He was not ashamed of it, even though he struggled with it. He sought help. He let his community know that he was suffering, and that I think made a big difference, that he saw that he would not be exiled, that he would be, that he could be supported. And that's also a message to, I think, those of us who are caring for people who are suffering, is to not shame them and to do what we can to support them. So that's the first thing, I think, is acknowledgement. And the second thing is to recognize that acknowledgement, an expression of suffering, at some point that we do all of that we can do, and we need to build a better life for ourselves and look for some sense of purpose and work, and, you know, just do the daily stuff to be better people and be of service and experience whatever joys we can experience. And I think the third major thing is then to, you know, to bind up this recognition of who we are and how we suffer and whatever capacities we develop day to day in some larger purpose that looks beyond the self and looks beyond our own limited lives and looks to what we can contribute to the world around us. And indeed, if we're thinking grandiosely, which I'm certainly want to do, you know, to think about how we can, you know, what we can offer to humanity and to history.
Do you think that there's a lesson from your book to the medical establishment in terms of their approach to depression?
Definitely. Holding the clinical perspective in mind alongside this humanistic perspective, I think, is one. Learning to look at people as stories and not simply as patients is another. The value of a biographical perspective on depression is that we get to see the whole life. And, you know, if you're looking at a 20-year-old person, you know, who's suffering from major depression, you can see that person is in the midst of a story and help the patient see that too. There are many changes yet to come.
We are just about out of time, so remind us about your book and your new book and how people can get in touch with you.
My website is my last name, which is shenk.net, or you could just Google my name, Joshua Wolfshank. We've mostly been talking about Lincoln's melancholy. You can find more about it on my website. My most recent book is called Powers of Two. I would love to hear from your listeners. They can email me on my website, join my mailing list, and I write to everyone who writes me, so would be glad to be in touch.
Joshua Wolfshank, thank you for joining us today on Madness Radio.
Hey, thank you. You're a terrific conversation partner. I really got a lot out of it.
You've been listening to an interview with Joshua Wolfshank. He's the author of Lincoln's Melancholy, How Depression Challenged a President and Fueled His Greatness. That's all the time we have on Madness Radio. Thanks for tuning in. You've been listening to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, co-sponsored by the Icarus Project, Portland Hearing Voices, and Freedom Center. Madness Radio is hosted by Will Hall, and producer is Leah Harris. Madness Radio is based at KBOO in Oregon and can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network. Contact us at radio@madnessradio.net.
And that concludes this morning's Monday morning radio zine. And stay tuned now for the noon headlines. And that will be followed by the noontime jamborees. So keep your dial right here at KBOO Portland. ¶¶
It's time for the KBOON News at Noon for Monday, February 2nd, 2015. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry on Sunday said that it will respond to Israel's continued expansion of illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories by referring the case to the International Criminal Court. Palestine recently joined the court against the objections of Israel and the U.S., which tried to stop the Palestinians from joining. The decision to take Israel to the criminal court came in response to Israel's announcement of tenders to erect 450 new settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. But even if the court rules against Israel, the ruling will be difficult to enforce since Israel has not signed on to the International Criminal Court and considers itself outside the court's jurisdiction. An office in Sweden has begun inserting microchips into the hands of employees. The microchips contain personal information and allow the workers to walk into the building without showing ID. They can also wave their hand to operate the photocopier. Civil liberties groups have challenged the move, which they say violates the rights of the employees who are being microchipped. The Swedish biohacking group, which is behind the technology, sees this as just the beginning of what they call human cyborgs, and are currently developing watches, glucose monitors, and other health monitors that can be embedded inside the skin. The government of Liberia began a trial of experimental Ebola vaccines today, vaccinating thousands of volunteers with two vaccines developed by the international pharmaceutical corporations GlaxoSmithKline and Merck. While the outbreak of Ebola is on the decline, Liberia remains the hardest